Thank you, thank you. Hi everybody, my name is Megan Gator, and I work at San Francisco Department of Medical. And I have a whole new appreciation for caregiving because I have a little one, 2 months old, and you may have heard during the presentation. Apologies for that, but it's going to be a whole new appreciation for how important domestic work is. And we're doing 8 loads of laundry a week, and they have been 3 a.m. and other times, just how important and how demanding domestic work actually is when you're doing caregiving. So I really appreciate the fact the work that all of the people on this panel have been doing, and that you have come in here presenting. I also want to recognize my co-authors for the report that we are going to be talking about today. I have no relationship, they told us we're supposed to put this slide in, I have no relationship to the folks that are potentially relevant. So just a quick introduction about health impact assessment. For those who haven't heard of it, it's a combination of procedures that is a tool emphasizing that it's not just one type of method, but a mix of different methods by which policy, program, or project can be judged regarding the health effects upon a population. So importantly, it's looking at what are the health effects on a population of a policy, project, or plan before the decision is made to inform the decision making. And particularly to look at the distribution of the effects within the population. So how does, who is disproportionately affected, what are the health equity impacts? Health impact assessment has been recognized increasingly as a tool to address the social determinants of health and promote health and policy. Most recently, it was sort of recognized by the U.S. National Prevention Council and the Prevention Strategy. There's an increased funding for it, which helps increase more HIV to happen. These organizations have happened in the state, right? As of the time I went on maternity leave, there's 140 HIVs. I think there's probably more of them than them. It's been institutionalized as a practice in other countries as regular ways to approach how do you inform decision making that you should be considering, not just the economic impacts, but you should be thinking about the health impacts of decisions. Where I work, we are lucky to be one of the national leaders in doing health impact assessment because we've been doing it for 10 years. A majority of our NHI has been on land use and urban planning and transportation policies, but we've done 3 now on river policies. Just quickly about Assembly Bill 889, the Domestic Work Employee Equality Experience in the Act of 2011. Gary and Jill talked about it previously. It's the bill, it's the California Domestic Work Bill of Rights. When it was first introduced, there were at least 11 components to it. By the time it got to Governor Brown's desk, it had been whittled down, unfortunately, to I think 4 points through different negotiations and conversations with the different constituents. The work that we did in the Health Department was focused specifically on the workers' compensation and the 8-hour maternity leave. The study that we did was unfunded. If we'd had more money, we may have been able to do more. And I also just want to acknowledge that San Francisco does support domestic workers. There's a number of resolutions that have been passed by the Board of Supervisors as well as the Human Rights Commission. So why did we analyze AB 89? We were very lucky to have collaborated with domestic workers for 8 years prior to since 2004, NIA, China, and Sherry Barron, who's in the audience, had helped us fund and work to work with La Colectiva to teach the angry cleaning training, and to work with the day labor program in San Francisco. That initiated a bunch of other collaborations, including working with another organization here at San Francisco that does also works with domestic workers to focus groups where the paid 6 days health impact assessment that we did. We've been continuing to collaborate over the past 8 years. In addition, we recognize that health impacts of labor policies are rarely considered. Usually, labor policies are considered in terms of the economic impacts or how it's going to impact the employer, but putting information about what the health impacts to the general population or to the workers is normally not part of the decision-making process. From our work in doing the paid 6 days and living wage HIA, we knew that it can actually help inform that decision-making process. In the paid 6 days HIA with the state legislation, the legislator is actually starting using health questions and questioning the opposition to the bill, saying, well, do you really want restaurant workers going to work sick? That had not been part of the discussion before the HIA had been done. At the same time, I worked on the program on health equity and sustainability, and it we focus on health inequities, and if you heard Guillermina's testimony, and which is there's many other women that also have had really horrific experiences, workers that are working with domestic workers are extremely vulnerable to violations and health inequities. So this is a summary of the participatory research study that was briefly mentioned for the San Francisco Bay Area. Put the slide back up, and particularly for those who in the occupational health section, I want to acknowledge 30% said that they had injured or experienced injury illness related to work in the past year, and that 20% were assaulted or threatened, and then when asked, 9% experienced violence. However, 30% of the population don't need to be affected, so that actually may have been higher in terms of the number of people that have been experiencing violence that just did not want to to report it. But if you look on the other side, you see that wage and hour violations are very common, very difficult work to work with domestic workers. So when you do have a health impact assessment, one of the stages is scoping. You start to think about what are the factors in terms of how the policy or policy or program or plan may impact health. So when we're thinking, we're brainstorming, how might having guaranteed 8 hours of sleep impact health. We thought, increased sleep quality, sleep quantity, increased irregularity of sleep, increased protection and recovery, and decreased symptoms of fatigue. And then we sort of looked at what the central health impact in terms of cognitive motor performance, how it impacts your immune system, the stress levels, anxiety, depression, obesity, diabetes, et cetera. And we'll go into these, but if you're interested in sort of seeing all of this, it's online. But this is basically a brainstorm in terms of what are all potential impacts, and then the health impact assessment is going through and trying to figure out where what does the research say, what is the evidence say in terms of how strong those connections are. The next step is to develop our research questions in terms of where do we want to actually focus our research and our literature views and our questions when we're interviewing people. So it's a little complicated and a lot of fun, but it's actually very simple. On the left-hand side, there's the code legislation and all the 12 different ways. Next consideration is which domestic workers would be impacted by the legislation. So with the 12 different points, not all of the legislation is going to impact everybody the same way. So household workers, home care workers, are excluded from overtime, but maids and nannies may be entitled to overtime. Yet domestic workers covers all of them. So there are a number of different parts of the legislation where they would be differentially impacted by the legislation. And so we were looking specifically with these and workers' compensation about who would be impacted. Also, expected utilization. Even though they have a law, how many people are going to be able to utilize it? And then what are the potential health effects of those of the legislative changes. At the same time, the characteristics of the population may increase or decrease their ability to utilize or access the health benefits of some type of legislation. So, for example, if you're a very low-income worker and you're guaranteed overtime, hey, that's going to more benefit you than someone who already is sort of a middle-aged worker, if that makes sense. Methods that we use are here, including this in case folks aren't familiar with HIV. Most HIV is all these different sets. We did a very large review of literature, analyzed census and Bureau of Labor Statistics data. We did focus groups with domestic workers, and we interviewed a number of different experts in the areas related to the two topic areas we're finding. There was a question before in terms of research. We came up with this estimate in terms of how many domestic workers are in California. This is based on American Community Survey data, 2005 to 2009. We came up with this with the Data Center, which is a major partner with the National Domestic Worker Alliance and other organizations, the local organizations to do the particular research study. We know that this is an underestimate, but this is sort of the best guess that we can get, because as Guillermina was saying, when you're trying to document how many people are working in domestic work, and they're not, in the Bureau of Labor Statistics, private households are routinely excluded from data collection efforts, people that are working in them and in private households. So there's a whole population that is cut off. In the American Teen Survey, you can sort of manipulate some of the industry and occupational classifications. I can explain that later if people are interested. To get up, this is how we came up with the number, but we know it's an underestimate in terms of the larger number of people that are working as domestic workers in California. As has been mentioned, we learned how they're excluded from the Fair Labor Standards Act and the National Labor Relations Board and from other federal legislation. We compared them to general workers as an occupational group, so we found that they're much more likely to experience different types of injuries on the work, and particularly about personal and home care aides, where contact was likely to be assaulted on the job. And we estimated that about 4,000 domestic worker occupational injuries and illnesses occurred annually, with one third of them being musculoskeletal. Looking specifically at the sleep provision, sleep is actually really good for your health. We learned that in a number of studies, it's really important for people to try and get out of sleep. If you don't, you have higher risk of hypertension, diabetes, getting in car accidents, your motor performance, particularly when you're caregiving, which is really important, goes down, and the quality of care goes down. With the workers' compensation bill, it actually was only, as I mentioned, the legislation is trying to cover those who aren't currently covered, so that would be covering those who work less than 52 hours or less than $100 in less 90 days, which we are thinking the majority make them housekeepers who work for multiple different employers for short periods of time. In general, workers' compensation is not something that there's a lot of information about in terms of comparing those with workers' compensation with those without workers' compensation, because it's generally considered a universal right. There's a lot of things that are looking at that access to workers' compensation, and so we need that the majority of population has considered. But within that, these are sort of what we were able to find in our literature, that access to workers' compensation does help with recovery, helps increase productivity and well-being, and it increases employee turnover, which again is also really important for caregiving. And we made a calculation that between 20 and 620 people that were previously ineligible would be able to be treated through workers' compensation if the plan was passed. As I mentioned, vulnerability is a really important piece of domestic workers' lived experience, and also in terms of what the impact of this legislation would be on the domestic worker population. I won't go into in depth, but they're really, really important aspects when we're looking into low-wage workers. How do the vulnerabilities impact their ability to utilize labor protection or benefit from the labor protection? There are, going along with that message, there are those barriers. If AB 89 were to be passed, there would still be employee fear of retaliation, unemployment, or the need for more income. Even though they might have the right to overtime, they might have the right to meal and rest breaks, they need to be careful of keeping them to talk about it because of the fear of retaliation. There's also a challenge in terms of coordination and coverage by other care providers while another domestic worker is sleeping. Gender, racial, and economic dynamics are also a factor in terms of their ability to sort of step forward and demand the right. And then there is limited oversight, data surveillance, lack of enforcement. So these are all barriers if AB 89 were to pass. We thought that today we would be talking about the AB 89 had passed. Unfortunately, it has not. But it's still, when it is passed, these are the barriers that will still be faced. But as Chairman Joe mentioned, part of the domestic worker organizing is helping to overcome some of these barriers by helping support and collectively educate the domestic worker themselves about what their rights are and provide the solidarity for stepping up to confront abusive employers. So as was discussed, unfortunately it was vetoed by Governor Bowen on September 29th. However, it's important to recognize all the accomplishments that have happened. It was supported by more than 100 labor, business, faith, and community groups, Richard Funke, the president of AFL-CIO, came in and lobbied on behalf of domestic workers, which is a first. They don't even cover domestic workers as part of AFL-CIO, but they still came because they recognize it's such an important movement that's happening. They received endorsements from the New York Times. There were many negotiations and changes to the bill and communication with the disability community, which was an important relationship building process. And it did successfully pass both the Assembly and the Senate, however, it was weaker. And so the coalition of domestic workers in California is still removing from that. It's just the reason that it happened to think about what their next steps are. Briefly, for an unfunded study, we found that this had a good number of impacts. We were really, really glad to have done it, most importantly because it helped build our relationship with the Domestic Worker Alliance, with Caring Cross Generations, with other domestic worker organizations, with low-wage worker organizations, with health departments. Additionally, we helped support the change originally. They had proposed having a five-hour emergency, and we have provided a lot of evidence that 8 hours is really a good number of sleep and that there's a lot of documentation of people getting more accidents and so forth when you have 5 hours. So they changed that in the legislation actually before it went to get voter reform. So that was a win early on. We also have quantified the number of domestic workers. Yamina had mentioned that they were using 200,000. That 200,000 estimate was the stuff that we had helped come up with. Also quantifying the number of people impacted by workers' compensation. The report that we developed, we've heard, have been used and distributed in a lot of legislative meetings, in media and grant applications. We're hoping that other people may be interested, particularly those in Massachusetts and Bravo, and others who may be in the audience, if there's other people who are interested in overcompensating the HIA in another state, there's a lot of opportunity to replicate some of the methods, but also do a lot of innovative research in the other parts, because maybe, again, we're only able to look at two of them. And we have much more intimate knowledge of Bureau of Labor Statistics data, American Community Survey data, and injury and illness data than we had had before. The report has been submitted to all these places, and this is the link to the report if people are interested in looking at it. And also, we just want to acknowledge there's a huge, huge number of people that contributed to the report, both as contributors in like reviewing and explaining certain things to us, for example, like the ins and outs of the labor law, which is way above my head. It was really helpful to have legal experts help us think through it. There were a number of reviewers who reviewed the report and gave excellent comments, as well as all the domestic workers who really contributed, that gave very personal testimonies and were supportive and encouraging of this report. So with that, I will end, and we'll take any questions for anybody here.
So before we formed the National Domestic Workers Alliance, there were two coalitions that did participatory research projects in coalitions with domestic worker organizations, one in New York and one here in the Bay Area, pretty much led by Christina Gandima and the Clinton Mujeres. In New York, with Domestic Workers United, both places we partnered with the Data Center to design and lead those research reports. In the Bay Area, we surveyed about 300 domestic workers, and in New York, we surveyed almost 600 domestic workers. So this data here reflects the results of the survey here in California. This was done in 2005, and so the survey that we just completed will be the up-to-date and first ever national research on this industry.
Thank you.
That's a really great question. The question is, how many employers are there? And that's a great question. It would be great for somebody to find out. I think one of the things that was interesting when we were doing our research and trying to identify what the number was, there we looked at the American Community Survey, and then we also looked at the state employment development department at the numbers, and it was significantly different by about 150,000 workers, and that was based on tax, like employers' records, in terms of like who's reporting that they have a caregiver, and 95% of the people that were in that in the employment development department assessments were people that were working in home base, whereas the other ones we saw there was a wider distribution, and at the I think it's something worth researching.
In this issue of how do we calculate the number of workers and the number of employers is an ongoing research challenge that we need your help on. The New York study and the work on the New York Domestic Worker Bill of Rights actually use an employer assessment to try to come up with how many domestic workers are there in the state of New York. And so they do some kind of assessment on the average income of the worker's employer, and then from there did an assessment of how many people are in that income bracket, and that's how they came up with the number of potential domestic workers in New York. But it's an ongoing challenge, and you know, we were working a lot with the International Labor Organization on the convention. You know, and it's like their estimates are that there would be 50 and 100 million domestic workers across the world, and that's like, well, you know, it makes good sense, but it's pretty great. So we need more help, and it also means that we need to be pushing our survey overall to be inclusive of the visible population of migrant workers in particular around the world. The New York bill is only private pay employee. California bill includes agency workers and private pay, but excludes IHSS workers. And that was a conversation with disability rights groups and the unions representing those workers in terms of that choice in the legislation. But the work that we're doing at the federal level is really trying to address the issue of how we value domestic work, care work in our society overall, both addressing the needs of all Americans to have access to this care, for it to be affordable, and for all of the jobs across the industry to be better jobs. The reality is it's been a very exciting growth of unionization of home care workers across the country. It's been the largest growth number of workers entering unions in recent years. But it's seen the least increase in quality of jobs. The unionized home care workers are still making $10 or less an hour. And that's an issue that we need to be addressing at the federal level and at state levels around how much resource as a country we're putting toward ensuring to provide care for our seniors and people with disabilities.
That is.
But if people have additional questions, we'll be up here. Thank you so much for your time.